Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the changes one expert would like to see in our education system, and why a Southern Arizona environmental group has had to stop some of its conservation work in the Sky Islands region. But first, a bill before the state legislature would ban encampments on college and university campuses. The bill's principal author, Tucson Democrat Alma Hernandez, says it's a reaction to last spring's wave of protests related to the war between Israel and Hamas. In Hernandez's opinion, the encampments where many of these protests took place were breeding grounds for anti-Semitism and lawlessness. On March 3rd, the House voted by a decisive margin to advance the legislation. But as it heads to the state Senate, it still has vocal critics on both sides of the aisle. They say Hernandez's bill goes too far and that its passage would endanger freedom of expression. Representative Hernandez recently joined us to talk about the bill as well as the controversy about her motivations. We should note this conversation took place before some revisions to the language of the bill, which attempt to clarify what constitutes an encampment. Hernandez spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman.
Some of our university campuses here in Arizona, unfortunately, got a bit out of hand when it had to do with these encampments. And I personally went to these in person after meeting with some of the students and hearing kind of the concerns. It was a disaster. Seeing how not only our campuses were, you know, truly being destroyed when it comes to property that was being taken down and they were being used as part of the encampments. Students behaving in ways that, you know, have truly no place on our college campuses, harassing students as they walked by, harassing staff. That should not be allowed anywhere.
Well, so can you give me any specific examples from your experience, just, yeah, you know, being around these encampments? What types of behavior are you referring to that for you were disruptive to safety?
Of course. So both at the Arizona State University and University of Arizona, intimidating students because they are Jewish and trying to stop them from being able to walk, you know, around the area that you're in, that's problematic. We heard from a lot of Jewish students that, quite frankly, were trying to find alternate routes to get to class.
Sure.
No student should ever have to, one, find an alternate route to go to class. No student should have to be in a situation where they are harassed or pushed, because that did happen at Arizona State. One student was pushed at one of these encampment areas.
But can I just ask you, Representative Hernandez, because I understand what you're saying about people getting involved in physical altercations, assaults. Obviously, that's something that nobody would be supportive of. But when it comes to something like having to take a different route to walk to class, what for you is the difference between that when it comes from something like an encampment and, say, somebody's foot traffic being rerouted because of a protest march? Why is the encampment different?
Well, one, the encampments are on college campuses. It's not, this isn't something that is protected. Like, you don't have the right, just because you're a student, to go in and set up an encampment and say, I'm not leaving the encampment until you meet my demands. Like, it's not only trashy, but they really caused damage to the university. It happened at the University of Arizona. There was construction on campus that they took apart to try to set up their structures. That's, in my opinion, that's stealing. And that's the big issue that we were dealing with on the calls with that administration was, you know, that we're telling them they have to leave at 10 p.m. because they're illegally occupying that area, and they're telling us they won't leave unless we meet their demands. That is where the problem is. At that point, you're trespassing. I'm all about people's First Amendment rights. I have gone to many protests in my life. I have protested for many reasons.
Can you say for you what would represent an acceptable form of protest? Because as you know, you've had some colleagues in, yeah, the legislature on both sides of the aisle actually say that they're concerned about what are perhaps some unintended.
Some of the concern, Yeah, some of the concerns that were brought up are I don't really, I'm still trying to understand where those claims came from regarding this bill would somehow prohibit someone from tabling and talking about their club. That's not at all the case.
Well, it seems like the concern, Representative Hernandez, is that the bill says that it would not be allowed to erect tented structures for a, quote, prolonged period of time.
Period of time.
And I think some folks are concerned that you might not necessarily be talking about an encampment in that case. There could be people who just want to hand out literature or people who want to speak from a podium.
I mean, the definition of an encampment is exactly what you just said. These encampments are very different from someone setting up a tabling event on college campus, trying to promote their club or whatever it is. We are not saying you can't do that. You can do that. But again, the encampments were set up with the purpose of staying overnight, with the purpose of staying there for days. Those individuals who are saying that it has anything to do with me trying to stop certain clubs from tabling on campus, you know, I've told them if you have language for an amendment that you want me to look at, I'm happy to look at it, but that's not the intent. There are designated areas for the universities when it comes to protest.
But I guess that's my question for you, Representative Hernandez, is as you've said, you're a supporter of free speech and of protesting. And, you know, it could be argued that the goal of a protest, even if it's a peaceful protest and there's not assaults or hate speech or whatever the case may be, is some form of disruption and even the issuance of demands, even if those demands are not coming from an encampment. So my question for you, I guess, is where is that line for you? What is it about the encampment specifically that crosses that line?
Yeah, I don't think we should be trashing our college campuses. And that's something that I've been very clear about. People bringing in couches, their coolers, and really with the intent of staying there to, as you said, disrupt. If you look at the ABOR, which is the Arizona Board of Regents, if you look at their policies, this isn't something that students are just allowed to do just because they're a student. There's rules people have to follow. What would people be saying if we had people out there who were literally calling for the death of Black individuals on college campuses? I guarantee you people would have a problem with it.
Sure,
so
of course, of course, of
how
course.
How is it any different?
Well, I mean, is that something that you saw people openly calling for the death of Jewish students?
Oh my goodness, yes. Yes, some of the chants. I mean, I went to several of these encampments. Some of the terminology and some of the quotes that they were using essentially, in my opinion, calling for violence. And they're literally calling for the complete, you know, destruction of Israel, and from the river to the sea, and saying all by all means necessary, and calling for violence against you, that's very problematic. How is this allowed? Like, how are these signs? Again, hate speech is protected speech. We can't stop people, but why are there double standards when it comes to Jewish community and Jewish students?
Well,
there shouldn't be.
I just have to ask, in the case of double standards, Representative Hernandez, I mean, you referenced the idea that nobody would be supportive of people making threats against Black students. But if we think back to the civil rights movement, technically, a lot of the civil rights protests were illegal at the time. If you think back on the lunch counter sit-ins or Rosa Parks refusing to ride at the back of the bus, these sorts of things, technically, those protests were breaking the law. So how do you square those two things?
Someone sitting at the back of the bus because they're being told you can't sit there is very different from a student being trying to get to class and being harassed because they're Jewish. Like, there is, in my opinion, no comparison there. You harassing someone because they are Jewish is not the same as someone sitting and protesting and not wanting to move because they're being told that they need to move. Like, that is very different. You know, we get protests here at the Capitol all the time. There's a gentleman right now walking around with a little sign. He can do that. That's, you know, that's something
right,
that we're not
right.
going to stop him from doing. So, but if he was running up to people and yelling in their faces and threatening, then that's a different story.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Representative Alma Hernandez, Democrat of Tucson, we really appreciate you coming on to talk about this. And thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
The future of education and education systems has been very much top of mind recently. Between debates over universal school vouchers on the state level and conversations about getting rid of the U.S. Education Department, my next guest has worked in education for years and believes there does need to be change. Ida Rose Flores is an author and educational psychologist. She lays out her ideas in her new book called The End of Education as We Know It, Regenerative Learning for Complex Times, which came out earlier this year. She joins me to talk more about this. And Ida, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it kind of seems like to some extent you're advocating kind of blowing up the education system in this country. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Well, I don't actually want people to blow up the system. In fact, I talk about this in my book, and I talk about the role of disruption. And we don't actually need to invest our energies at this point in time in disruption, because education as we know it is on the verge of collapse. We got a little taste of that during COVID. We started to see that there's, you know, not only cracks in the system, but that the system wasn't able to handle the complexity that it was experiencing. And, you know, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the COVID-19 pandemic was not an anomaly. Hmm. It was, it came from the complexity of having, you know, so many billions of people on the earth, and we're so much more connected. And so, when you have individuals connected, that's what generates complexity. And so my argument in the book is that not only are our systems, they're just not capable of, and they were never intended to handle the level of complexity that we have in our world right now, but they're also structured in such a way that we're not educating people to be able to handle the complexity that we are experiencing in our world.
Well, so given the fact that I don't want to say everybody, but most people, I would imagine, want every child to have an education and to have a high quality education. And yet, as you're saying, the system really isn't capable and it wasn't built for handling this many kids. Like, what do we do about that?
Well, you know, it's not necessarily the number of kids. I mean, just think about it. We have these really complex issues that we're facing in the world. So, homelessness, the lack of affordable housing, inequities in wealth, and then we have, you know, we're on the tail end of I mean, COVID is still with us, but now, you know, we're thinking about the bird flu, you know, and how might that spread? So there's all of these complex phenomena that we're facing. And yet we're structured for the Industrial Revolution. So we're structured to create, the educational system is structured to create a workforce that's educated just enough to be able to work in factories and to throw switches and to follow directions and to not think critically. And yet that's not what we need in order to address the issues that we're facing in our society and around the world.
Is this a deficit in schools teaching students like how to learn and how to think?
So, you know, I'm really glad you raised that issue, because a lot of people will say, well, schools are teaching kids what to think but not how to think. That's really a very dangerous misconception, because we as human beings, like, you know, I walked in here today and you offered me the seat, but I already knew where I needed to sit, because what we psychologists call affordances in the environment tell me what to do. And so if you just look at the structure of schools, they are structured as factories. I talk in the book a lot about separating, sorting, and sequencing, and go through all the ways that we separate, sort, and sequence kids and knowledge and adults in schools. That's very artificial and is not related at all to the way we actually live our lives. And the thing that's kind of troubling about this is all that separating, sorting, and sequencing, like the idea that we need to have kids in first grade, second grade, third grade, there is no evidence from the learning sciences or from developmental science that that supports kids learning at all. In fact, we have evidence that intergenerational learning and cross-age learning is far more effective than separating, sorting, and then, of course, sequencing through the grades. So what's going on there? And what's going on is that it's structured so that from a very young age, we have humans that are used to standing in line, used to going to the bathroom when someone else tells them to, that are used to just following someone else's directions in a very piecemeal sort of way. That is teaching how to think, just the experiences. You don't need a textbook. You don't need a curriculum. You actually don't need any education dollars. You just need to structure your days so that it's this sliced and diced experience.
But as you're saying, that doesn't really necessarily teach students how to figure out what to do about water scarcity or how to, as you reference, you know, come up with more housing or more affordable housing. Like, it sounds like what you're saying is schools are doing a good job of teaching people, teaching kids how to sort of get on in the world and live in the world, but they're not really teaching them how to maybe change the world or how to solve the problems in the world.
So you're right. And schools do an excellent job. You know, you hear a lot of at the large soundbite level about how schools are failing. But actually, our education system has been phenomenally successful. I would say in excess of 95% of adults that are living, breathing, working right now in the United States went through industrialized education. And it created this workforce. I mean, the Industrial Revolution was successful because of that workforce. But it was not always, you know, we can't say that that's always a humane way of educating people. But now we have to grapple with it's also now obsolete.
All right. That is author and educational psychologist Ida Rose Flores. More of our conversation in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what it takes to make it in Arizona's food truck scene. A food festival organizer talks us through the ups and downs of running a food truck here in town. But first, let's return now to my conversation with author and educational psychologist Ida Rose Flores. Her new book, called The End of Education as We Know It, Regenerative Learning for Complex Times, came out earlier this year. In it, she talks about the need for changes in the American education system. So, Ida, if the current model isn't working, what would be a better one?
Well, there are a lot of examples. For example, the Circle School back in Boston. There's Verde Valley School, which is, you know, up in the Verde mm-hmm. Valley, yeah. Really close to Sedona. There are lots of examples of these little pockets of doing school in a whole new way. So I define in my book, in the very first chapter, I say, look, you know, I want to just get the reader to be thinking in more open terms. I define school as any place set aside for learning of any kind for any age of people. And usually that's a group, but it could even be an individual. And so if we do that, we start the process of being open to whole new ways of doing school. And so, you know, if you start to think about schools as places where learning happens, as opposed to, I often talk about, you know, if you sliced the top off of any elementary, middle school, or high school, if you were flying over in a plane and you slice the top, it would look like an egg crate inside. That's our mindset about what school is, and yet it doesn't have to be at all.
As opposed to like going to a museum or going to a farm, or it sounds like in your mind, going literally anywhere where somebody can learn something.
Yes. So I specifically talk about how, you know, in this model, museums are schools, and Wild Heart Farm, which is, you know, about 2 hours north of, maybe not 2 hours, of Phoenix, is a school, you know, and how, you know, a scout troop meeting in somebody's garage could be thought of as a school. So when we start to think about that, these pockets of education and what our current school buildings could become, you know, when you talked first about blowing up the system, I actually don't want to blow up the system. I do want to blow up, although I don't like the violence of that.
Sure.
But I do want to blow up people's mindsets about what school could be.
I want to ask you about that because just thinking about what you're saying from a parent's perspective, it sounds awfully scary to be the one to sort of send your student to potentially be a guinea pig at a school that in a parent's mind might be a little bit outside the box or maybe really outside the box. Mm-hmm. Because to your point, it's not what has been done in this country for decades.
So I would suggest to you that when you send your children to our current way of doing school, you're sending them to be guinea pigs with what is only a very recent experiment in how people learn. And we have lots of casualties from those experiments. And I talk about that in the book from my own experience and from what I've seen with students, my own kids. But, you know, if you think about, you know, you said, well, we've been doing this for decades. Well, you take decades and you put that against the long history of humanity. And the truth is that industrialized education has only been around for a blip. And it is a huge experiment. And we are living with a lot of the consequences, which are that people don't know how to think in complex ways.
Well, it sounds like the problem that you're identifying and maybe the solution also is really, I'm going to say twofold, but it might be more than two, in terms of how do you go from the system we have to the system you're envisioning? And then how do you convince people, parents, students, policymakers, that this is the right approach as opposed to the approach that everybody is familiar with? And as you pointed out, a lot of us have gone through.
Well, that transition, I think, is already happening. So, you know, part of the what I see as the weaponization of education or making it a wedge issue, you know, when we talk about how funding streams are used for schooling, we see far more people who want school choice. And we immediately ideologically think that that's only a conservative perspective. But that's not hasn't been my experience. My experience has been that people across political, ideological spectrums want different ways of doing school with their kids, want more flexibility. And so what I see happening, and I do think that this is the way that most change happens, is I see kind of islands of little pockets of these changes coming up and schools learning to shift. In the beginning of my book, I talk about visiting a preschool on Maui, where I used to live, and the way that they do school in this Hawaiian language immersion. It's not just Hawaiian language, it's Hawaiian culture, cultural immersion preschool. And they have many of those schools. And of course, in the 70s, when those schools first started, early 80s, there were just a couple. But now that movement has just really taken off across Hawaii. So I see the same thing happening in different places around the country, like I mentioned some of the schools earlier.
Do you find that these kinds of changes tend to happen sort of from the bottom up as opposed to policymakers in a city or state or even at the federal level saying, okay, we're going to try something a little bit different. Here's some money. Go do it.
I think it can happen both ways, but you know, all of the schools that I can think of that are functioning in this way have come about by groups of parents, or it might be, you know, some visionary in a local community organizing things and it catching on and people saying, oh, wow, I really want my kid to experience that. I want them to be immersed in that way of learning and thinking.
Ida Rose Flores is an educational psychologist and author. Her latest book is called The End of Education as We Know It, Regenerative Learning for Complex Times. And you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. A nonprofit environmental conservation group in southern Arizona has had to stop some of its work because it lost more than $1 million federal dollars. The Borderlands Restoration Network has had $1.2 million frozen. That money was allocated as part of a pair of laws signed by former President Biden, but was paused under an executive order signed by President Trump. Wyatt Myskow is a Southwest correspondent for Inside Climate News and has written about this. He joins me to talk about what he found. And Wyatt, let's start with what the Borderlands Restoration Network is and what kind of work they do.
The Borderlands Restoration Network is a conservation group of 25 or so employees, as well as a score of part-time employees and volunteers who do, as their name implies, restoration and conservation work in the borderlands of southern Arizona. They do watershed management work. They restore habitat after wildfires. They manage a seed barn and nursery where they supply seeds and native vegetation for both, you know, recovery efforts, but also for people to buy and, you know, grow in their own backyards or to eat. They grow some really great broccoli. I sampled some while down there. And they're made up of a variety of trained hydrologists, biologists, people who do this type of work for a living and have studied it for years and have been working on this type of work for years, if not decades.
How much of their budget is funded by the federal government? Like, how much of their work is dependent on getting federal money?
Yeah, so like a lot of nonprofits, they rely on donations and grants from philanthropies, but also contracts with the federal government. And they had $1.2 million frozen by the federal government when the Trump administration took office via various executive orders that President Donald Trump signed. And those were contracts that the Borderlands Restoration Network had signed over the past year with various federal agencies, mainly the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, to do exactly the type of work they do, restoration work across southern Arizona, also internships for rural youth in the area. And that accounts for about 40% of their operating budget that's now frozen, even though the courts have ordered that funding should be unfrozen.
So what does that mean for their work? I mean, you said it's about 40% of their budget. Are they still able to do some projects that maybe are funded by the other 60% and just not execute these contracts?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, they still have some funds. They're still able to do some limited amount of work, but they have not been working on, you know, the projects those federal funds were going towards. I mean, they don't have the money to do it. Essentially, I mean, what they told me is that they're operating incredibly slowly, really just waiting to hear back. Is this funding unfrozen? What's really tough about this is that these were contracts that were, you know, the funding came from congressionally approved bills. Mm-hmm. And it went to dedicated to a variety of different things like watershed restoration, restoring habitats after wildfires, et cetera. And those were signed contracts. Those were signed agreements that have deliverables. That's really concerning for them right now. The summer is coming. It's going to get hotter. They have deadlines to meet for a lot of these projects, but they can't meet them right now because they don't know if they'll get reimbursed for it. But also, right now, the weather is great to be doing that kind of work in the field. And if the funding gets unfrozen, but it's July and it's 110 outside, it means they're going to have to wait even longer.
Are those the kinds of projects that they're not really able to do right now in terms of watershed restoration, invasive species management, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's the kind of all of those and above. They have their own wildlife preserve, and they have more private contracts with, say, like local ranchers in the area to do some of this work. But a lot of their work was on, you know, U.S. Forest Service lands or Bureau of Land Management lands, right? It's operated and owned by the federal government for, you know, the enjoyment of everyone. And they can't do that right now. And that's the vast majority of the work, and maybe the most impactful, because those are, you know, I mean, these are really big contiguous landscapes that are in need of help, and they can't do that work right now.
So what are the folks with the Borderlands Restoration Network saying are the impacts of this? Like, what kind of effect is this having on that part of the state?
Yeah, well, there's a variety. I mean, one, the Borderlands Restoration Network is Patagonia's second largest employer of that town. I mean, it's a small town, but they have around 25 people employed there. And those jobs are kind of on the line right now. I mean, they still have funding. Not everyone's going to lose their job potentially. Yeah. But there's real risk. I mean, they have real concern that, you know, if by the end of this month some of those funds don't become available again, some folks will have to lose their jobs. And that's, you know, incredibly impactful for a small community where, I mean, there's limited amounts of jobs in these, in this field in the first place, also in the town, obviously, given that it's a small town of around 800-ish people.
Yeah.
So if someone has to lose their job and they live in the town, I mean, where do they go? That's a big concern. The other kind of impacts on the ground, I mean, just sticking to conservation and the environment. I mean, the Sky Islands, where Patagonia is and where they do their work, are some of the most biodiverse places in the world. I mean, truly, if you've been down there, you know just how special and unique it is. It's these refuges from the desert heat that allow a variety of wildlife and plants that you wouldn't expect in the desert to live in the desert. But that landscape is changing. It's drier, it's hotter, and there you have the threat of wildfires, invasive species that have been introduced. The landscape's changing rapidly, and their work is doing, you know, making a dent in preventing some of that stuff and protecting the environment. So there's real risk of, you know, some of these places continuing to be degraded. And thirdly and finally, they had internships that they had to cancel for around, you know, 15 local Southern Arizona youths from these small towns to do learn about conservation and learn this kind of work. And they're not able to have that this year because that internship was funded by the U.S. Forest Service and that grant has been frozen. And so they had to cancel that.
When you talk to the folks with this organization, like, what do they say about sort of the scope of organizations like theirs around the country that are in similar situations? Because obviously the Borderlands Restoration Network, this is not the only group that's had funding, federal funding frozen. So, like, how do they sort of see their place in this larger issue?
Yeah, great question. Across the country, you know, billions of dollars have been frozen by the Trump administration that were passed by Congress under the Biden administration, mainly the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, that, you know, dedicated billions of dollars to doing this type of work to address climate change. The lack of funding now means that across the country, groups cannot do that work. And, you know, I think they said it best, the executive director of Borderlands Restoration Network, is that you may not believe in climate change. That's okay. But if you live in Arizona, you know about wildfires. You know about drought. And that's really what their work's about, is preventing those things that we know are getting worse. And that's the case across the country, right? And that means all this funding's frozen, and a lot of states cannot access it. A lot of groups like theirs cannot access it. It's not just these small nonprofits. I mean, we're going all the way up to state governments, federal agencies. A big concern of theirs is that at the same time these funds are frozen, federal workers are being laid off in the Bureau of Land Management, in these corresponding agencies they work with. A big fear they have is maybe the funding gets unfrozen, but your federal counterpart is no longer employed, and there's no one there to work with to get this project done, which means, I mean, projects that already have begun are being stalled, are being lost, are not going to be able to continue. One, that's wasting funds. But two, it means this work that's to, I mean, help prevent some of these things and recover from things we know are issues like droughts and wildfires cannot continue.
All right. That is Wyatt Myskow, Southwest correspondent with Inside Climate News. Wyatt, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Food trucks might seem like a given in Phoenix's culinary scene today, but actually they're a pretty new phenomenon, and they've had their ups and downs over the last decade or so. From a fast and furious rise to a pandemic-inspired reset to a potential bubble today, it's been a wild ride for food trucks in Phoenix, and our next guest knows it well. David Tida is a food festival producer here in Phoenix. He's the guy behind the annual Taco Fest and Phoenix Pizza Festival here in the Valley. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him more about the food truck scene today and where it began.
So it was about 2010-ish. We were just sort of coming out of the recession. I think it was just a product of people starting to think of starting their own business in a different kind of way, you know, like, as we're all going through this societal change, people are like, well, you know, I'm tired of the chef grind. I want to hit the open road and open a food truck. And that's when we made the jump from the roach coaches that were servicing construction sites, that you had somebody saying, well, I want to have a themed truck that's doing a little more upscale or imaginative food, and it's wrapped and it has an Instagram account and all of that. So I think that's when it all really started, at least here in the Valley.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure this existed elsewhere before, but did you call them roach coaches? Is that the tradition this came out of? What is that?
Yeah, so a roach coach is essentially a lunch truck that goes to a construction site. You hear their horn is very recognizable, mm-hmm. and that just signals to all of the construction workers, hey, if you're on lunch break, come on down, get some food.
So this is the tradition. Okay. So there was a big upswing, 2010 and the years after that, right? Like, do you remember Food Truck Fridays downtown at Feed? I remember those. Like, it was a cool and booming business for a minute there.
Well, I was one of the people who didn't believe that there would actually be a food truck scene here in town. A lot of us were like, yeah, there's a limit to it. And the reason I believed that is because we don't have a pedestrian culture here. Mm. You think about cities where food trucks thrive, like LA, New York, you have people walking around so a truck can just pull up on a curb and you've got customers right away. Whereas here, although that Friday food truck roundup was a beautiful thing in downtown Phoenix, we all had to go to the trucks. They weren't coming to us. So back to that idea of bringing the food to the people. This was more about just, oh, I'm eating from a food truck. This is so cool.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
It felt cool. It was different.
You know what I mean? Because food trucks were already popping off in LA and New York. And so it made Phoenix feel like, yeah, we could have a food truck scene too. But in the back of my mind, I was like, this isn't going to be a thing. There's a limit. And wow, was I proved wrong.
Yeah. I mean, it really was a big thing. And then the pandemic hits, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So now nobody's going out. You know, we all can't, quote unquote, safely gather. And the food truck scene kind of, it dwindles a little bit because there's no festivals, right? But a lot of the food truck roundups started to pop up again, and now they were the only place we could safely gather because although live events were canceled, these little kind of neighborhoody things that were like, you know, 100, 150 people, 20 trucks, families, it's a way to get out of the house because we were all cooped up and losing our minds. And I think that built a thing. Now more people are getting exposed to food trucks that otherwise weren't going to festivals.
Mm. So people got creative there, it sounds like. But they still found a place to thrive.
Yes.
So let's talk about where the scene, quote unquote, stands now, because it feels like there are so many events full of so many food trucks that it would be hard to keep track.
Right. So I think we're in a bit of a bubble. There's maybe a little too much to go around because some food trucks are struggling. But a lot of food trucks are starting to get creative again and now like stationing their truck. To give you an example, there's a food truck called Tacos Don Hector that found a permanent spot on Van Buren, and they have built out picnic tables and heaters and misters, and they've got a couple speakers. And so it's like you're in this outdoor restaurant, but you're eating from a food truck, but it's also stationary. So what is it really? So I think we're in that stage right now where it's like we're in the great shift again.
Another shift. Yeah. That's a good thing usually, right? When people have to get creative when there's competition.
Totally.
So let's talk about some standouts right now from this kind of burgeoning and really big food truck scene. You mentioned one truck on Van Buren there. What are some of the success stories, some of the stuff that's really interesting that food trucks are doing right now you think people should know about?
Yeah, so there is a pizza truck called... I love saying this name, and I can't say it with a straight face. Gabiche Italian Eats.
Oh.
And don't you just want to do that with your hands?
Yes.
Gabiche Italian Eats. This guy, oh my God, Chef Pauly, this guy can make anything. And he puts a lot of time into every single ingredient. Like, you're not just going to get a tomato sauce on a slice. You're going to get like a Sunday gravy kind of thing, like a thing that's been cooking for 2 days. Mm. I think your listeners have to find Gabiche.
Okay. All right. A good one there. Yeah. Well, what else is on your list right now?
So there's these two ladies that signed up for my pizza festival, and they do souffle desserts. And so when I heard that, I thought, nobody's going to want a souffle. Who wants souffle? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not in a steakhouse.
Sounds fancy, yeah.
Right. But did a little research, come to find out, it's a popular Asian street food. So the way that they make these, it's like on this griddle, and it's the fluffiest of eggs you could imagine, or an egg-like batter, I guess it is. And then they'll top these with like ube flavors and boba and all kinds of like Asian-inspired ingredients. And it's such a fun thing to eat at a live event. So they'll do farmers markets. They do festivals. You can, you know, just follow them on Instagram, you know, and find these two ladies that operate as Cloud Soufflé.
Super different stuff. Yeah.
Super different.
So how common is it anymore, David, for these food trucks to kind of make it to the brick and mortar status? Is that the goal anymore?
I don't think it's the goal. I think it depends on your business model and what you're looking for. So there's two trucks that are related. It's one family. They're called Don Fito's and Taco Bros. Mm-hmm. Well, they operate, you know, like 6 or 7, maybe even 10 trucks at this point.
Wow.
Under those two names.
Yeah.
But they have a Don Fito's location or two, a brick and mortar that acts as their commissary.
Sure.
So now they can prepare all their foods in that commissary and then get it out to the food trucks, which have different catering gigs, you know.
Part of the lore, right, like the stories around food trucks was that it's like, you know, it's like a low barrier to entry. Like you don't have to have the money or the chef training to end up in, you know, a fancy restaurant as a cook. You can kind of cook the food you love and know and do well, but in a truck that you could maybe afford with a small business loan, right? Like,
yeah.
Is that still the case?
That still reigns true. Absolutely. Yeah. It's definitely cheaper. I mean, these trucks are expensive. I mean, they're upwards of $100,000, but,
whoa.
But I mean, you know, but you're not paying rent.
Yeah.
Your insurance is a lot less expensive. What you're saving in money, you're paying for in the grind of having to load everything in this thing, load it out, clean it, just the constant inspections, all of it. These people have the toughest skin.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about like just all that the road throws at them, no pun intended.
Literally. That is David Taita, founder of Phoenix Fest, co-creator of the annual Phoenix Pizza Festival and Taco Fest, owner of Barcoa Agaveria in downtown Phoenix. Thank you so much, David, for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Kayla Long and E.P. Bradley are collectors, and not just of one thing. The walls of their Central Phoenix home are covered in paintings, trinkets, and other artsy odds and ends.
I might have like a slight hoarding problem. So
slight.
If I like finding cool things, I buy it. Like those clowns right there. That's just a bunch of old vintage clowns glued onto a piece of glass.
Well, explain that.
That's a Tibetan cowbell that I got at a store.
Explain the 17th century birthing chair in the corner. Like,
yeah, that's an antique birthing chair. with a pigeon on it.
If you look closely at the eclectic collection, which includes Lucha Libre art and knickknacks, fake food attached to the wall, and various themed clocks, one recurring theme dominates: pigeons. There aren't any live pigeons inside, but there's just about every depiction of the bird you can imagine, from plushies to faux stained glass to painted portraits. EP opened King Pigeon Thrift and Vintage in Phoenix last October, but the couple's love of the bird started long before the shop opened, when Kayla had an encounter with one a few years ago.
I was outside late at night after coming home from a bar, so I had had a couple of drinks. So it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I just hear this awful sound, because we also have feral cats that we take care of. So we're the Central Phoenix Zoo. One of the feral cats got a pigeon, and it was fighting, and I went over and picked it up, and I just was like, okay, I need to like care for this pigeon. So I brought it into our bathtub and I Googled what pigeons eat and found some frozen peas and some water and took care of it. And that was Burr Murray. And that was the very first pigeon that we ever got.
I woke up to a sign on the bathroom saying, "There is a live pigeon in the bathtub." That's all it said. Yeah, okay. Live pigeon in the bathtub. Cool. Cool. This is what we're doing this morning.
Pigeons are really smart animals, and maybe Burr Murray like had a girlfriend or something and was like, hey, this house is kind of cool. We should go check it out. And it's like, if you give a mouse a cookie, I think the pigeons just kind of communicate and we're like, there's this crazy lady with really big hair and lots of stuff in her yard. She'll feed you. She'll
and
take
also,
care of
if
you.
You're sick, we'll go online and figure out pigeon antibiotics and order it.
Yeah,
that has happened. That has happened in our lives.
So we have Bramble. Bramble's the one with the messed up feet. He always has like a scowl on his face.
What's the one with the legs?
That's Heidi Plum. So we have Heidi Plum, who's got like the longest pigeon legs I've ever seen in my life. And they're also covered with like down feathers, which a lot of pigeons just have the scaly, like scaly legs. Heidi Plum has like very like gorgeous gams like for a pigeon. And she's super sweet. We have Nightlight, and he's named Nightlight because he's really fat and he likes to post up on our outside light that has a photo cell on it. But because he's so fat, when he sleeps on it, it turns, so it'll be like 9 o'clock in the morning and the outside light will be on because Nightlight is on it.
Yeah. We have Prince, who's purple.
I have Timothy that's been around for 3 years that lands on my feet, eats out of my hand, is super cool and super docile. He's missing a toe. He's mostly black. And I say he or she or they because you don't, it's very hard to sex pigeons, so I don't know specifically. They know that they're safe here and that they're loved here and that they'll get fed here and taken care of.
I'd say at the high point, usually we've got about 30 to 35 hanging around the place in the morning.
Our friends ask about the pigeons, like when we go out or if we run into somebody we haven't seen in a while, they'll be like, how are the pigeons? I update on my social media all the time, like updates on them. It's probably like my most interacted post that I ever post. People ask me questions about them. So people started giving pigeon stuff as gifts.
Tons of them everywhere, like everywhere you look.
This is a little Etsy gift that somebody, it's just a little 3D like printed pigeon that's super fun. This guy, and there's a bunch of these around the house, but these are little wind-up pigeon toys that I'm obsessed with. That was an ornament that now just lives on our TV. After our very first pigeon, EP painted that for me, and that's just a bird painting. This one's probably my favorite. My friend Jasmine got that for me while she was on vacation and thought of me and got me a pigeon painting that somebody made that I absolutely love.
Yep,
so that one. This is right in front of our toilet, and it's a pigeon reading a book on a toilet that says pooping on people. That one's super fun. We got more out here. We're on our pigeon blanket that has pigeons on it. Some weird tin painting or art piece that is just a giant pigeon looking at someone. A pigeon way sign. Another pigeon little piece of tin art. A stuffed pigeon. Another stuffed pigeon. Like, they're just kind of all over the place. There's another wind-up toy pigeon. There's another one over there. There's lots of little bits and pieces of pigeon gifts and pigeon art that we've received over the years. So the coolest part of it is the actual like pigeons themselves, you know?
Yeah.
That was Kayla Long and E.P. Bradley. You can see photos of their pigeon collection at theshow.kjzz.org. Well, now you'll be thinking of Bert and his pigeon Bernice for the rest of the day, along with the song, You're Welcome. That'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.